So the big question is, can they really feed the world? Can sustainable agriculture feed the world? Because if you listen to the champions of the new green revolution, into Gates and Monsanto, they say, look, we need all solutions. You know, we need the productive, science-based solutions of GMOs, and then we need the environment-friendly, sustainable agriculture, which doesn't really produce very much. But we need a bit of that. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I'm going to cite this study, but I'm also going to tell you about my own experience. When I got to Latin America, farmers had been on the Green Revolution treadmill with the pesticides and the fertilizers and the hybrid seeds for about almost 10 years. They destroyed their soils. They were getting lower and lower yields every year. They were applying more and more fertilizer. They were going broke. They were producing about a ton of corn per hectare. It's very low. You know, the world average is three. In the United States, we can produce, if you really pump it up, you can produce up to 10. Right? No one does because it's too expensive, but you could. When they switched over to sustainable agriculture and added organic material to their soil and conserved the rainwater so it didn't run down the hill and into the gullies, they immediately saw increases of production of 100, 200, 300%. We have rain-fed corn in Mexico on the Meseta Central. It's a dry area, something like 900 millimeters of rain a year, producing at 5 tons per hectare. So what is this myth that sustainable agriculture produces less? That comes from this country. That comes from the north. And the explanation is very simple. Because in the north, we overproduce. We make the land overproduce by pumping it full of fertilizers and water. It produces more than the actual capacity of the land. So when you take those fertilizers and that water away, of course you get a drop in production. You're already producing at very high levels. 6 tons, 7 tons. Take away all the artificial ingredients, yeah, you drop down to 5, 4 tons immediately, of course, because that's what you're relying on. Right? So we have this myth here that somehow sustainable agriculture produces less. Now, organic farmers eventually make the transition. They build up their soils. They conserve their water. Right? They lower their input costs, and they bring the production back up. Not quite as high as the overproduction, acceptable levels. But it's here that you get the drop in production. But in the global south, you get an increase in production, and that's where it counts, because that's where most of the farmers are in the world. And they produce half the food. You want to double the amount of food? You can't double the amount of food here. You can't go from 6 tons to 16 tons. You can't do that. It's not economically viable, even if it was physiologically viable. But in the global south, the billion farmers, you want to go from 1 ton to 2 ton? You can do that. You can do it in a year. Right? That's where the hope lies. And so this study by the University of Michigan took a look at nearly 300 examples in which they compared sustainable agriculture to conventional agriculture around the world. And what they found was very interesting. They found basically what I just told you on the basis of my own experience, that organic agriculture could feed the world now and 20 years from now easily, particularly because of the advantage that it has in the global south, where you get tremendous increases in production by shifting over to sustainable agriculture. The United Nations carried out a study in Africa, and it found the same thing. It found that organic agriculture was widespread. And now, when I talk about organic agriculture, when conventional agriculture and agronomists and our GMO friends talk about organic agriculture, they act as if it was a throwback from some dark, unproductive past. The traditional ways which were leading us down the road to hunger. Nothing could be farther from the truth. First of all, those traditional ways were not so unproductive at all. Second of all, what we're talking about is not some old, old way of doing things. We're talking about improvements upon traditional agriculture, which now are incredibly productive. And that's what was found in agriculture, and they found that organic agriculture could improve livelihoods and improve food security in Africa. The good thing about organic agriculture is that it lowers costs, and it also reinvigorates local economies. So they found that villages that were practicing organic agriculture, new organic agriculture, sustainable agriculture, had healthier economies, had more localized economies. In other words, the food system under sustainable agriculture is the first step into turning the food system into an engine for local economic development. Ending poverty, and then you end hunger. Anyway, study after study has shown that this is the case. So this isn't an untested hypothesis by any stretch of the imagination, as it is often presented in the mainstream media. In fact, it's much more tested than GMOs are. We don't know if GMOs are going to work at all. The only thing we've seen out of GMOs for the last 20 years is BT corn and Roundup Ready. None of those increase intrinsic yields. Those are both about the industry making more money, not about increasing the amount of food. So what we're faced with is movements around the world. They're basically fighting for food sovereignty. They're taking back control over the food system, sovereign from the corporate food regime. They control their inputs. They control their outputs. Food sovereignty is basically, I mean, there's the definition which Via Campesina, which is an international peasant federation, gives food sovereignty, which is people's right to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically and sound and sustainable methods, and the right to define their own food and agriculture systems. I think the essence of food sovereignty is a democratization of our food system, where we get to decide about our food system rather than a handful of monopolies. I think we should be clear about the corporate food regime, that it's basically, it's been written about quite a bit. In a food regime, think about it as all of the institutions and all of the rules which control our food from farm to fork. So, the WTO, the USDA, the World Bank, the IMF, the FAO, these are the institutions that set the rules which control our food. And on top of that, you have the corporations who tell the institutions which rules they need. Right? So we have Monsanto, Syngenta, ADM, Cargill, Bunge, Walmart, Tesco, General Foods, Safeway. These are the corporations that set the rules. And they are institutions in and of themselves. Now, this regime is managed. And what we know about this regime is it goes through two phases. It goes through a period which reflects capitalism. It always goes through a period of liberalization of markets and then a period of reform. And if you think about it, we had completely liberalized markets, which led us into the Great Depression, the crash of 1929, and then the Great Depression. And then we went into a period of reform, where we said, no, you can't invest that way. We said, no, we're going to have a floor price for our grain. No, we're now going to establish grain reserves. No, we're going to give a guaranteed price to farmers. Yes, we're going to put up tariffs and we're going to protect our markets and our farmers. So that's the reformist period. And it comes in after markets have all but destroyed the economy. And this has happened through the history of capitalism. And since we have a corporate food regime, which is basically a capitalist food regime, it does the same thing. It goes through periods of liberalization and periods of reform. And think about FDR and the New Deal and all the reforms that were put in. They were put into agriculture as well. And then when Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher got into power, we enter into a period again of neoliberalization. which is just another period of liberalization, where markets are allowed to run rampant. That is still where we are today. Now, many of us might have thought that with the end of the Bush era and the entry of the Obama administration, that perhaps we're moving into an era of reform. I don't think this is the case. I think we have rumblings of reform. But in fact, we have a reassertion of the neoliberal regime. And we have a reassertion of the neoliberal corporate food regime. Now, how does this work out? Within the corporate food regime, we have a tendency of neoliberalism and we have a tendency of reform. And we have different institutions and different documents which lay out the strategies of both neoliberalism and reform. As it turns out, at the present time, reform is very, very weak. You can see the difficulty of the Obama administration introducing any reforms to our healthcare system, his unwillingness to introduce any reform into the food system. Right. But we do get a bit. We get the Farm Bill reformed a bit. We get a little bit more money for research in organic agriculture. We get a little more money shoved over to community food systems, a little more money for farmers' markets, these types of things. We are not able to touch the subsidies. We're not able to control overproduction. These are structural issues which the neoliberal regime is unwilling to reform. Now, the good news is that we have a food movement, a worldwide food movement, growing rapidly around the globe. If you're involved in the food movement here, you might have felt a little isolated sometimes, maybe a little depressed about things. Maybe the task is too big. Maybe you're treated like you're crazy. Yeah, you know, you go to the farmer's market. That's all nice for you, but, you know, we got to get serious here. You're not part of the lunatic fringe. You're part of the cutting edge. Because all around the world, we see people taking back the food system. And they're taking it back agroecologically, and they're taking it back with CSAs, with food policy councils, with farmers' markets, with farmers' movements, farmer-to-consumer movements, right? They're building food sovereignty. Now, the food movement is also sort of divided into two tendencies. One is which I call the transitional tendency. These are the doers. These are the ones who are doing the farming, who are going back to the land, who are going to the farmers' markets. Right? These are the ones growing organically, eating organically, going vegetarian, going vegan. Right, doing the practice of food sovereignty. And then we have another tendency, and I call that the transformational tendency, because these are the advocates and the activists, and these are the ones that want to change the rules. They want to change the institutions. In fact, they want to do away with the institutions. They want to do away with the WTO. Take agriculture out of it. They'd like to do away with the World Bank while they're at it, and the IMF. But basically, they want to change the rules and the institutions, the structure of the corporate food regime. Why? Because otherwise, all these very promising activities, all this extremely hopeful practice of healthy food, fair food, will never have a chance. You can't win. The rules are against you. The institutions are against you. So they have to be changed. That's all. Now, how? And I'm going to give you my hypothesis based on a historical record. And that is that reform doesn't come about by reformists. Reform comes about when there is no choice but to reform. Otherwise, the situation becomes ungovernable. For all the respect I have for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he did not initiate the New Deal simply because he was brilliant. He instituted the New Deal because there was no choice. Labor was strong. People had taken the streets. They were ripping down the monopolies and the financial institutions which had sent them into destitution. The country was becoming ungovernable. And that is when they instituted reforms. Reforms come about through militancy, not through reformists. So what's very important is for those who work on transformation, the activists and the advocates, and those practitioners in transitional forms of agriculture and marketing, and fair food, and food justice, we have to come together. We have to come together and build a strong movement capable of embarrassing our politicians into making the right decision. We have to make it so there is no other choice but for them to do the right thing. That doesn't happen without an awful lot of hollering. So I invite you all to holler. Thank you very much.
That was Eric Holt Jimenez on food sovereignty. He spoke in Seattle. Eric Holt Jimenez is the executive director of Food First and co-author with Raj Patel of Food Rebellions. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, we've always offered AR free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as Lester Brown, Michael Pollan, Chris Hedges, Raj Patel, Howard Zinn, Vandana Shiva, David Suzuki, John Pilger, and Noam Chomsky. To access our vast audio catalog and to find out about subscribing to AR, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Eric Holt Jimenez on Food Sovereignty, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. And remember to support the station that airs this program. Special thanks to Ed Mays. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Stephanie Brown is our editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with India's Santur Maestro, Shiv Kumar Sharma. Rag Marwah.